Welcome to The Collection. On this week's show, BGC strategist Mike Ingram.
Frankly, I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. Unless and until China actually does what it says it's going to do, which is going to restructure its economy, but I wouldn't hold my breath on that one.
And journalist Anil Adami.
Trying to get on the housing ladder is just something that I don't think people really even want to think about in today's generation and age. It's not a priority at all. We'd rather be doing something else.
I'm Zach Meir. It may be said that perhaps the fall of the British steel industry was just about the best scenario in which our hip, Beats, headphones-wearing Prime Minister would cut short his holiday in Lanzarote, given the recent terror threats to the UK. At £300 a pop, the earwear is presumably not helping the UK balance of payments, and nor is allegedly allowing the Chinese to dump steel here at the expense of 40,000 Port Talbot-based Tata workers. We are reminded that given the way the government has no teeth when it comes to the Chinese, or with the likes of Google, Facebook and Apple on tax, the question of Great British sovereignty being recovered on a Brexit appears a moot point. Of course, one of the Leave campaign's biggest criticisms of our friends in Brussels is the red tape, nanny state approach of the unelected federalist tyrants. Unfortunately, the Institute of Economic Affairs think tank has found Britain imposed the highest rates of tax on wine, beer, sugar and cigarettes in the EU and is third behind Finland and Sweden in the nanny state department. This is difficult to blame on us being in the EU, although the 1.6 million EU nationals just announced to have moved here in the past 9 years may very well be. Welcome to The Collection on Audioboom. Today we have Anil Adami, who's a broadcast journalist, and Mike Ingram, who's a stockbroker at BGC Partners. Welcome, people. A tumultuous week as far as British industry is concerned. Let's see and hear how tumultuous it has been.
Earlier today, the business minister, Anna Soubry, said the government is prepared to consider all options. All options, of course, being her turn of phrase. How do you interpret that?
I mean, it's obviously positive. We have seen the government take action over the last 6 months. I mean, we would say far more needs to be done. There is no sort of silver bullet that will sort of solve all of the issues in the UK market. However, there are things that the UK government can do and haven't done, for instance, on business rates, which they put on plants and machinery, which is basically a tax on investment. And a company like Tata has put billions of pounds into steel across Europe and has been taxed in the UK to do that, which is, we find, sort of ludicrous. So there are a lot of things that the government can be doing. They are doing some things, but there is a lot more that they can be doing. And also, you know, the speed of action that needs to be undertaken. We have long said that, you know, further job losses will come about unless action is taken. And, you know, we're still unfortunately having to say that.
OK, that was Dominic King, head of policy at UK Steel, speaking to Share Radio. It reminds me of one of those situations where Ronald Reagan phrase, Mike Ingram, where he said that if it makes money, tax it. If it keeps making money, regulate it. And if it fails, subsidise it. So it looks like we're into the final stretch there of that particular phrase.
Yeah, but this isn't a failure of markets. It's a failure of the lack of markets. And, of course, the 800-pound gorilla in the steel world is China. And China, for several decades now, has just had rampant investment, well, some would say overinvestment, malinvestment, particularly in heavy industry, particularly in industries like steel. They currently produce more than half the world's steel. And we've got massive overcapacity. And, of course, you know, it's a globally traded commodity, and UK steel is going to feel the backwash from that. And unfortunately, even if we took out the whole of UK steel production with all the job losses and all the political fallout, it would hardly put a dent in the problem. You need to take out hundreds of millions of tons of capacity. And that is something that very few countries are actually willing to do at the moment.
But it's quite sad. I'm just reading the tweet of Karen Jones, the First Minister of Wales. Wales has faced up to tough times before. We will always stand in solidarity with our brilliant, skilled workforce and with our communities. But unfortunately, that skilled workforce is overpaid and not as efficient as the Chinese workforce.
Well, no, I wouldn't agree with that. I mean, you say you're overpaid relative to China in any number of industries. It doesn't necessarily mean that we aren't doing what we should be doing. The thing is that many industries, including the steel industry in China, aren't run as businesses. It's one of the reasons why the Chinese economy is in trouble. It's one of the reasons why one of the credit rating agencies, S&P, downgraded the outlook for China only today, is that a lot of these businesses are being used as employment agencies. And if these businesses were simply functioned as employment agencies, then fine, we can keep all of these companies open just to employ people, to do nothing. China hasn't gone through that yet. It's one of the reasons why, you know, to sort of look at a broader picture, the concern that a lot of people have had, that markets have had about China over the last 8 or 9 months, is not unfounded. But they just haven't bitten the bullet. They need to close stuff down. Then they need to lay people off so that capacity can be taken out of the system, price of steel can rise, and we can actually afford to pay the people in places such as Port Talbot, and UK can still can make a decent return on their money. The playing field is not level at the moment at all.
Anil Adami, 40,000 people likely to lose their jobs imminently. If you were in power, if you were a prime minister or chancellor, etc., or even the business secretary, who seems to be making some noises about doing something as well, Sajid Javid. What would you do? Just pay up and save those jobs, or let nature take its course?
That is a big position that you've just given me. I would, as much as I feel really sorry for all the people who are going to lose their jobs, it's a ship that's already sunk in my eyes. I think that the steel industry in the UK is dying. I think the government, the fact that they haven't been here and acted upon it quickly is nothing in the face of they haven't acted upon it for many years
they've
now.
Acted very quickly. David Cameron rushed back from his holiday. I think that's, you know, he interrupted that. So that was a quick reaction there. But
I think Corbyn's reaction of being on the ground was probably quicker than that. And the fact that there was nobody at the negotiations when Tata was in India, and there was no one at the table negotiating there. I think that Tata's been losing money for many years now, and the government couldn't have not known about that. And if they didn't know about that, that's even scarier. So I think that, no, the government hasn't acted. I think the government doesn't care. And whatever they're saying now is just a nice little cover-up for all the people who may be losing their jobs very soon.
So when they say they're considering all options, that means they're not actually considering any options. That's the yes minister type of political answer.
It's crocodile too.
Yeah,
it is, isn't
absolutely.
It? And I think you're right. I mean, I believe that Tata's lost £3 billion over the last 5 years in the UK. And you know, it's a publicly traded company. These numbers are out there. So, for you know, the government now hand-wringing over this is pretty pathetic, in my opinion. But the options are very, very limited, and as has already been pointed out, you know, EU state aid rules preclude them from really putting a chunk of cash in there. They don't want to nationalise it. Actually, it was interesting enough that the Scottish government actually nationalised one of the mills, I think two of the mills actually, in Lanarkshire, before it being sold to another investor a little while back. But that was only because they knew there was a buyer at the end of it. That's not going to be an option for the Conservative government. So I'm afraid this ship looks like it's going down with all hands, unfortunately.
So we should almost take the view that it was lucky that Tata were there for at least a few years to take the losses which of an industry which should have gone years ago.
Yeah, well, they took over Chorus in 2009, wasn't it? I think. So, I mean, again, I'm taking it, sorry to bring it back to, you know, things overseas, but really what should have happened over a period of years, and I'm talking about 15-ish years, is that when China came into the World Trade Organization, we should have been a lot more strict with them in terms of dumping on the market. But because so many companies were lobbying and they were salivating over this market opening up, they turned a blind eye, particularly in the services industry, just because they don't care about manufacturing. They don't care if people don't make things anymore. And what they've done is they allowed China to build up massive overcapacity. They've allowed, which would never have been economically viable if they didn't have a centrally controlled economy. And what they've done is they helped destroy manufacturing industry within Europe. And it's not all about, well, you know, uncompetitive wages. We're never going to win that race to the bottom. But we can at least have a more level playing field, and it wouldn't be quite as devastating as it's going to be. And this is frankly, I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. We're going to see a complete hollowing out of the manufacturing base of Europe. We're going to see a lot of unemployment on the back of that, unless China actually does what it says it's going to do, which is going to restructure its economy. But I wouldn't hold my breath on that one.
But without wanting to sound like Marie Antoinette, which I obviously have a lot in common with her, letting people eat cake. This working as a steel worker or whatever they do, they're beating metal. I don't know. I'm obviously not an expert in that particular process, but it seems to be akin to the horrors of coal mining in the 80s, and you know that obviously the miners didn't go down without a fight. But I mean these are old industries. Can't we get into sort of fintech and more technology and chip design and produce new things rather than metal bashing and digging holes in the ground? Is there another wider message there?
I think it's clearly been a trend over the years. I mean, the services industry dominates in the UK, it dominates in the rest of Europe, and it is a trend. All I'm saying is that what we're having, I think, are perfectly viable businesses actually being driven out because you don't actually have a market. I don't think this is market forces at work here. I think this is a number of countries. China's in pole position, I have to say, making politically motivated, politically directed investment decisions, and everybody else being asked to compete on a market basis. That's not going to work. It's simply not going to work. You know, fintech, fantastic. But, you know, I would hate to be in a situation where we'd had entire industries, quite large industries, where the UK was completely underrepresented. I think, you know, we have a contribution to make in a number of areas, not necessarily coal mining or metal bashing, but I wouldn't be dependent on a whole bunch of stuff from other countries because, that, you know, you can't always rely on that.
But, I mean, there are other areas in the in the public sector which are crying out for labour, you know, and so the NHS needs people. Presumably, some of these good steel workers can find jobs in DVLA, HMRC, those sorts of organisations. And if all else fails, even the BBC, that might work too.
Well, it depends how transferable the skills are, of course. But I mean, one of the things the government actually can reasonably do is help in that transition.
And just final point on this, because you know we've discussed it at length, but there was nobody even blinked when RBS or HBOS went down 7-8 years ago. We've got to save these companies. Billions were pumped in there. I don't think the cost of British to save the UK steel or the British steel industry will be of that order. Should we just put our hands in our pockets and save the steel industry, Anila?
I just want to make a point on what you said about it being an old industry. And I think that we are completely in a global market now. And so the fact that people will lose their jobs, I think they should be reskilled. I think that's the only thing the government really can do, is to reskill people, create new jobs, and look at somewhere where it's a market that maybe isn't growing in another country, and we could be the first to do it here. I think we need to move with the times. I mean, like the coal industry went down, clearly it's happening with the steel industry as well. And we just need to find a different market to conquer.
But Mike, is there any difference between the steel industry going down and the banking sector going down 7 years ago?
Well, it would have been, because I mean, if we'd allowed the banking sector to implode, then you know we wouldn't be discussing this in a studio. We'd be in caves on the Welsh border trading beads. You can't run a modern economy without a banking system. So unfortunately, as horrible as it might have been, as expensive as it might have been, as unjust as it might have been, we had to bail the banks out. Unfortunately, we don't have to bail the steel industry out.
Okay, well, next topic. We're in the run-up to April Fool's Day, the day before April Fool's Day, and seems to be a good occasion to introduce a living wage, according to George Osborne.
The new national living wage will be compulsory. Working people aged 25 and over will receive it. It will start next April at the rate of £7.20. The Low Pay Commission will recommend future rises that achieve the government's objective of reaching 6% of median earnings by 2020.
Right. So living wage sounds like a sort of socialist left-wing policy, but this far-sighted government is... making this initiative. Anila, are you a pro a living wage?
I don't know. I'm slightly on the fence with it because although it sounds great, because it's, you know, it'll help people and I'm all about helping people, it's not really going to help everyone, especially councils and care homes and people who are looking after the elderly. So carers basically are really going to suffer from it. And big companies like Tesco, B&Q, are already cutting recruitment, slashing overtime, and axing staff perks. So it's come with a complete downside to it. And I think that if an introduction of an increase in the living wage is going to be introduced, I think it needs to come with some kind of rules where you can't kind of slash the benefits and bonuses just because you're increasing the living wage. Doesn't make sense to me, that.
So it is basically something which Tesco and Sports Direct can, you know, sort of benefit from that because they can afford to do that, but the small businesses actually have to pay more and it hurts them much more. Mm. Is that the case? I mean, they're almost choosing whether to employ somebody or not, whereas with Tesco it makes no difference whatsoever, or very little difference.
Larger companies almost by definition have all more options to claw it back, don't they? And as Anita quite rightly said, you know, we already know some of the things that they're going to be doing. And ultimately, many companies have the option of just increasing the prices of, you know, the goods and services they're selling in order to offset it. I mean, one of the things that I'm most interested in is why a Tory Chancellor is introducing this at all, because it would be a fairly controversial move from a Labour Chancellor. But from George Osborne, what's going on? Now, part of it is he has a narrow financial interest because he's saying, well, we need to bring income support, tax credits and so forth. We need to bring that down. And in order to take up the slack, we need companies to actually pay their employees more. So really, I suppose from that perspective, he's saying, well, actually government, he would say a Labour government, intervened in the job market, and we need to kind of unwind that as painlessly as we possibly can. What I would, however, say is come back to the, you know, what we were talking about actually in the context of Steel, which is, you know, this economy, the UK economy, and we're not the only one, has been pretty good at creating jobs, but the jobs that we created have been extremely low paid, and obviously there's a immigration meme which has been attached to this in the Brexit debate as well. And I just think that what we were seeing years ago, you know, and I grew up with Margaret Thatcher and so on and so forth, you did actually see, well, we let markets do their thing and we create wealth in the economy and that trickles down and everybody benefits to a greater or lesser degree, but everybody's better off because we're growing the pie. That trend actually stopped more than 10 years ago. And all we're seeing now, unfortunately, is capital wealth being accumulated by people at the top. You're seeing it in income disparity, etc., etc. And the flip side of that are the sort of people who are on the national minimum wage. And I do worry, and this is not something I worry perhaps in my lifetime, despite my advanced years. But I do worry about, you know, when what kind of environment my daughter, for instance, is going to be in, because I do actually think we're in a situation where a lot of companies really have too much power over wages, some sort of form of corporate feudalism. And ultimately, it's not even good for the companies themselves, because when they continue to squeeze their own employees on wages, what they're effectively doing is they're impacting their own top line. Because if people don't have disposable income, they can't go out and buy products and service. They can't do it. So, you know, I'm wondering, well, we've got, you know, if we look very far ahead, where are we heading to in terms of the economy? Are we heading towards, you know, Star Trek, where everybody's, you know, wants for nothing or whatever? Or are we heading towards the Hunger Games? And I'm a bit worried we're heading towards the Hunger Games, which might be cracking good films, but it's not a sort of world I want to live in.
Well, I'm definitely a Star Trek fan myself.
Well, live long and prosper, Zach.
Spock and everything. But I think you sort of alluded it to at the beginning of your answer, that it seems to be the reason that it's a Tory government and George Osborne are bringing this forward is because it's an attempt to try and get people off the benefits bill, or to get them out of the welfare state. Because if you know, the more you have in your pocket, it's better for somebody not to be working at all and get benefits on that basis, rather than having a small wage where it's much more difficult to argue that you need a top-up.
Yeah, well, I think when Labour introduced income support, it was anticipated to be a $2 to $3 billion price tag in an economy which at the time was doing relatively well. And it's 10 times that now, so it's completely unconstrained. So it's not unreasonable to to pare that back. And they're saying, well, the private sector, having benefited from effectively what was a public subsidy for private enterprise, you now have to pick the ball up. And, you know, it's not as if corporates haven't had a few perks along the way. I mean, they're getting reductions in corporation tax.
Right, but you, I mean, maybe for both of you, I mean, just an answer to this point, that would it be better if this was the first initiative as far as living wage is concerned, then maybe over the next 5 years it became, let's say, £15 an hour or something, you know, let's say a decent figure, and this, you gradually ramped it up, to make it so that it was a meaningful minimum wage, and it gave companies enough time and the economy enough time to absorb that.
I don't sound like Karl Marx. I think what we need to move towards more generally is more of a stakeholder approach. I think that, you know, capitalism has evolved, but I think capitalism as we know it is in danger of actually destroying itself. As I said, you have this situation where, you know, you can't continue to squeeze your consumers all the time, because all you're going to end up with is no flat top line. You're not going to have any revenue growth, etc., and all you're going to be trying to maintain that margin. And I could argue that's where we are in the world at the moment, where nothing's growing. Well, people aren't consuming. Why aren't people consuming? Well, they're not getting paid. You know, you can't have one or the other. So I think we need to move perhaps more towards where there's more formal, more structured representation of labour. And, you know, Germany gets by on that kind of model perfectly well. And I don't think it's a bad direction to move in. I think unbridled capitalism can be highly destructive, and we saw that only a few years ago in terms of the Great Financial Crisis.
Thank you, Carl. Right. Speaking of such issues, one of the phenomenon of the last 5-10 years, or since the financial crisis, has been everybody piling into the housing market in this country, aided and abetted by Mr. Osborne with the Help to Buy and Help to Create a Bubble and all the other tax breaks and stamp duty, some deadlines and all this buy-to-letting mania that's going on. And it seems to have left a lot of people think, you know, you're either in it or there's no way. If you're not in it, there's no way you can get into it now. It's a sort of distant dream of being a homeowner. And you also, do you really feel like spending hundreds of thousands of pounds on bricks and mortar, where you could live off that for the rest of your life quite happily if you had enough of the deposit? The headline this week is that the Tinder generation is swiping left on investment or investing for its future. As I'm definitely not the Tinder generation, and I don't know if I would qualify for being on that particular platform. I'd have to leave it to other people to maybe talk about that. But the Tinder generation, I presume, are people who are in their 20s and 30s, something like that. I don't know. Can I ask the question?
I'm not on Tinder, but I guess it's my generation yet.
Right. And so the swiping left is presumably what would happen to me if I was on Tinder.
No comment.
Right. OK.
So, yes. That's a yes.
Thanks, Mike. Right. I just wanted to see.
I don't know how to use it.
Right. So people have just like thrown in the towel, which is a disaster. And it's two things. It's almost like a live fast, die young type of mentality, which apparently young people do like. And I'm still waiting for that to apply to me. But there's also the thing of, you know, just saying, it's just totally out of reach. Let's just forget it.
We're literally not building for the future, are we? What I did there? But it's crazy, isn't it? I mean, you know, the government's gone out of its way to have various, you know, financial incentives to get people on the housing ladder, and of course the Bank of England have floored interest rates. We're in the eighth year, I think now, of the rates of 0.5%. But the basic problem is we don't build enough houses, and the houses that do get built get absorbed by property developers and so on and so forth, who, you know, targeting other people or buy to let. So, you know, it all comes back to the same basic problem. And of course, you're loading people up perhaps very early on in their careers and in their lives with a lot of debt. I would say that household debt is one of the problems the UK economy has, and now we're helping promote the next generation take up that same sort of mantle. It's all very unhealthy.
I think with the theme of almost every show is that I've been able to talk about the, which is my pet subject, which is not difficult to talk about in this scenario, is that, you know, 1.6 million people have come to this country in the last 9 years from the EU and beyond. I mean, obviously, there's going to be a housing shortage and a housing crisis off the back of that. But we're pretending as if it's just, houses are just really expensive now.
Yeah. And the Bank of England are very worried about buy-to-let as well, because it's taking a lot of the housing stock out of circulation. I mean, the housing stock in the UK is growing at something like 0.6% a year, And buy-to-lets growing at, what, 17%, 20%, something like that? I mean, these are unsustainable dynamics. All you're going to do is create... This is one of the reasons people worried about things like HS2. They said, well, all you're going to do is create sort of dormitories for people who are shuttling to London, except it's just me pushing prices up in Manchester and Leeds.
Yeah, but we need that because we need, you know, if you don't have a pension, your pension is the property you live in, which presumably at some time, you know, when you're in your 60s and 70s, you will downsize from to pay for your care and, you know, your medical bills, etc. So, you know, everyone does actually need to have a sort of a nest egg for the future. And if the Tinder generation, and maybe, I mean, I'm not bothering to buy. I'm not going to buy a property now because it's just no point. I mean, I'm too old. It just, you know, it'll take me years for that mortgage, etc. You know, to pay it off. So it seems absolutely pointless. I'm just renting. And other people who are younger than me are also throwing in the towel on the housing market. I've got no savings because there's no interest. Don't get any interest from the bank, and I've got to take my chances on the casino of the stock market. It doesn't sound very appealing, does it?
Sounds like you need that national living wage.
Well, yeah, hopefully, hopefully one day. From tomorrow, I think I could be a contender.
well, I guess I'm the Tinder generation, so I can comment. But trying to get on the housing ladder is just something that I don't think people really even want to think about in today's generation and age. It's not a priority at all. We'd rather be doing something else, like putting money into travelling, seeing the world. Renting is fine to get by. Those kind of long-term investments aren't viable at the moment at all.
Yeah, and isn't that ironic if you've got like another 80 years to live?
It is, but it's just not affordable at all. You just can't afford to buy a house.
So this is the interesting thing, though, when you were talking about, Zach, about, you know, you need this nest egg, you need this kind of annuity in place. And I read somewhere, and I hope I'm not misquoting, that I think one in three, I think it was over 50-year-olds, have a property, a second property, as a source of income. So they were talking about, you know, silver landlords, or I presume they're talking about, you know, their hair or whatever, if you still have it. And... But that's great. But all the measures which the Bank of England and taxation measures, etc., that George Osborne's brought in, are all targeting these small landlords. They're not targeting the companies which have more than 15 or more properties to let, and they're the people who are taking up most of the housing stock.
Yeah, but I'm looking at the City AM article regarding the percentage of London households owning property, and you've got all the old people of 65 plus, the couples, over 80% are sitting in a property. So I mean, they're laughing. If you're at sort of 16 to 24, it's 20% of couples. And I mean, you've got to be a couple, number one, so you've got actually to live with somebody, which is some people might not like that either, especially if you're a Tinder user. And then you've got, you know, really it doesn't, you know, the 20s and 30s, it's a very low percentage of people owning a property. And they're never going to be on board unless there's a crash of some kind.
It's going to be like Japan. I mean, children are going to be inheriting their parents' mortgages. It'd be lovely.
Is for these younger Tinder people to start to try and sort of put a little bit of strychnine in the coffee of the grandparents.
Bag for life, yeah, I'll stick it over my head. Thank you very much.
Right, I'm not sure how that will work. That
wasn't a suggestion, by the way.
No, incitement to... But it is that, and these 65-year-olds, they've got another 40, 50 years to go, so it's a problem, isn't it? They're happy.
Well, by definition, it's becoming an intergenerational problem. But until we start to build more houses, it's not going to be solved.
Right. I was just talking about the stock market as the casino that was one of the options, you know, for the nest egg. January, February this year, everyone, you switched on the radio, watched TV. Everybody was saying, you couldn't find anybody saying fill your boots. The FTSE's at 5,500. Yeah. Mike. Apart from you, maybe?
They were the same people who were saying fill your boots on December the 31st, of course. So, you know, fickle people.
Is there an explanation which won't take 3 hours to explain?
Okay, so as you know, Zach, and I've got a view that the global economy has massive problems, but I think everybody's waiting for what we call the Lehman moment. Yeah, we had the Lehman Brothers go and bust September the 15th, 2008, and nearly brought the whole global financial system down around our ears. Everybody's waiting for that kind of blow up and very sensitive, but because they haven't really seen it, they kind of conclude that everything's kind of all right. They thought they might have got a whiff of it in January because they said, oh, banks have got bad debts, and they were focusing on the financial system, they were focusing on the banks. As I said to you before, Zach, you know, off air, what we had in 2008, 2009 economically was a cardiac arrest. What we're going through at the moment in terms of lower growth, and remember in the last budget, the Chancellor lowered his estimate of the trend rate of growth in the UK economy. That's happening throughout the whole world. China's very centric to that, I'm afraid, again. And so what I'm likening to this to is more sort of emphysema. It's sort of very creeping, it's gradual, etc. And it is going to put increasing stresses on the global economy. And, you know, equity markets are going to have these occasional panics. But, you know, in terms of the commentary, it's a bit like a boiled frog. You know, if anybody told you that in 2016 we'd be not only talking about pretty much zero rates, but also talking about negative rates... If you'd been told that in 2008, 2009, you would have thought the global economy was really in a mess. But nobody's really talking about it. But the answer is it's in a mess. That's as short as I can make it. I could make it a lot longer.
Well, that's a relief, isn't it? Anil Adami, broadcast journalist, and Mike Ingram, stockbroker at BGC Partners. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
With thanks to Mike Ingram and Anil Adami, this has been The Collection. I'm Zach Meir.